This call is being recorded.
Good morning, everyone. This is a conference call of Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and I'm Sierra Dahl, I'll be your host today. Plana Rob from Christian and Barton is an attorney over there, and she'll be talking about some of the things that are happening over in Virginia, and Michael Walton at Green Spaces will be discussing some of the things that are happening in Tennessee, including the TVA. So, Plana, why don't you go ahead and start us out?
Sure. Sierra asked me if I could address some recent energy policy changes in Virginia, addressing matters impacting utilities and touching on some net metering developments. So, I just want to let everybody know that I'm going to be talking about bills that passed in this current session of the Virginia General Assembly session. Everything is not final until April 5th when the General Assembly comes back to act on the governor's vetoes. Governor McAuliffe is on pace to out-veto any of his gubernatorial predecessors, but unfortunately those vetoes don't include enough bills that impact energy policy. So, and this is where I need to inform you of my bias. I work with customers and competitive suppliers, so I tend to view utility-friendly bills with a healthy dose of skepticism. I teach an energy law class, and at the beginning of the year, I start out with this quote, that the trouble with most folks isn't so much their ignorance, it's knowing so many things that ain't so. And, I believe that our General Assembly in Virginia does not appreciate the downside of the energy policy refinements they keep enacting, and so it's a source of some frustration for customer-oriented folks like me. So let me give you exhibit number one as to why some of the energy policy that recently enacted isn't so great from a customer perspective. We enacted something detractors have been calling the so-called community solar bill. This came out of a stakeholders group that was supposed to be reaching consensus among a diverse group of, environmentalists, utilities, some net metering folks, but somehow it managed to produce only utility-friendly bills, even though it was the stakeholder group was supposed to be diverse and do something other than that. So what this bill does, Senate Bill 1393, is launch a utility-controlled and administrated solar option. So basically, utilities contract for the output of solar facilities to be built in Virginia, and they sell the electricity to subscribers under programs to be approved by the by our State Public Utility Commission. What I would have called the real community solar bill, which was Senate Bill 1208, got killed in subcommittee. That was modeled on programs in other states, and it had the backing of a distributed solar collaborative, which was a stakeholders group that composed of everyone but utilities. But that died on the vine. So we're the consumers do get an option they didn't have. It's just it's just not what I would consider true community solar. It's really because it's got so much utility control associated with it. Exhibit number two for this energy policy that's not so great is expanding a permit by rule process to encompass utilities. Virginia, frankly, doesn't have much that makes it attractive to renewable developers. One of the few exceptions is the permit by rule process, which simplifies the regulatory process for developers of small projects. And under the misconception that things aren't biased enough in the utility's favor in Virginia, Senate Bill 1395 now increases the size of the solar wind projects that are eligible for the streamlined permit by rule process. And in my admittedly biased assessment, helps out the utilities when really the purpose of this was to help out the smaller renewable developers. Then exhibit number three, which I think is why Sierra first got interested in this topic, is moving backwards on net metering. We had fairly standard, not terrific, but fairly standard net metering options in Virginia up to this year. And then along came Senate Bill 1394, which establishes what's called agricultural net metering, But what it truly is a buy-all, sell-all program for agricultural generators of renewable energy. It was presented as a win for agricultural net metering, but I think it's more properly characterized as a win for utilities and a loss for customers. This program is going to replace the existing agricultural net metering rules. And, you know, one of the concerns is that we've got a 1% net metering cap. So, you know, utilities can do net metering up to 1% of their load, but we think this is a kind of a false net metering program that's going to max out on that 1% cap without giving customers true net metering. Proponents of the bill, the utilities, say the program should be economically beneficial to participants, but those of us who aren't proponents haven't been able to figure out how it offers generators any options they don't already have under the federal PURPA law. So then exhibit number four of energy policy that's not so great from a customer perspective is impeding third-party purchase pair agreements. HB 2390 was billed as a win for advocates of third-party purchase pair agreements, and these enable customers to purchase power from on-site facilities, on-site solar facilities, as a means to help finance such facilities. I wouldn't characterize it as a win. I'd characterize it as a loss. We have a pilot program for PPAs already in our largest utility service territory. This bill was purported to expand the pilot program in AEP service territory, which is our second largest utility in Virginia. But it limits the expansion to private colleges and universities, and it poses a fairly tight cap. So the end result is that it lets a small sliver of customers get authorizes PPAs in AEP's territory, but it basically outlaws it for everybody else. You know, we had a good regulatory ruling this past summer, which looked like it was going to give all of the customers in APCO's territory or AEP's territory access to using third-party PPAs, and this pretty much rolls that back. And then exhibit number five, and this is perhaps I should get the reward for the most creative. You know, we've expanded our definition of renewable power in Virginia to include pump storage using abandoned coal mines. HB 1760 allows either of our two big utilities, Dominion, Virginia Power, or AP, to seek rate recovery for a scheme to use abandoned coal mines for pump storage facilities. And one of my favorite blogs on Virginia Energy described it this way: if you think this sounds weird and possibly dangerous, you're not alone. Using the idea to keep water out of coal mines to avoid the leaching of toxic chemicals into groundwater, that's usually the idea. Apparently, no one has ever thought of using coal mines for pump storage before, and neither the company that would construct the project or the sites under consideration or the technology to be used have been revealed. So a lot of skepticism on our brand-new idea to use abandoned coal mines to do a pump storage facility. All right, and then exhibit number six, and I am just about to shut up here. I wanted to address the politics of the Clean Power Plan. When the Clean Power Plan rule was being finalized a couple years ago, Dominion Virginia Power, largest utility, insisted that the General Assembly pass a bill freezing base rates to protect ratepayers from the impacts of the Clean Power Plan, because that's the kind of good corporate citizen they are. It turns out that when you freeze rates, you also you prevent the base rates from going up, but you also prevent them from going down. So consumer advocates have said this allows Dominion to keep about $1 billion of ratepayers' money it would otherwise have to refund. So a bill got introduced this year saying, well, you know, really the Clean Power Plan isn't going anywhere and will not go anywhere under the Trump administration. So let's get rid of this rate freeze bill. That didn't work. And then to add insult to injury, Dominion said, well, okay, we'll keep the rate freeze bill there, but let's also put some adders on top of these frozen base rates. So they got a HB 2291 allowing charging ratepayers for the cost of upgrading their nuclear facilities. And then they passed what is possibly my personal favorite, SB 1473, which virtually guarantees that Dominion can add $6 billion in riders, in rate adders, for an unprecedented program to underground existing distribution lines. The notion is that it wants to improve reliability and needs, in the end, $6 billion to do that. But, those that aren't fond of the bill note that it directly benefits only 6% of its customers in terms of improving reliability. And overall benefit to the system, Dominion without this program has 99.98% reliability. And with this program, it will have 99.9% reliability. So the notion is not worth $6 billion to get that improvement. And then let me end on a positive note. There is some evidence to the contrary that it's all doom and gloom in terms of energy policy in our Commonwealth. SB 1226 was enacted to allow solar developers to keep confidential certain proprietary information that would otherwise be subject to FOIA. So we had a locality that wanted to enter into a solar project on a public building. And again, because PPAs are a little bit questionable in Virginia, they had to use some creative financing. And the solar developer said, look, we don't want this creative financing to get out there because we spent a lot of money developing it and we don't want to make it public. So that program was discontinued because the locality said, look, we're subject to FOIA. We've got to release it. So a bill was passed this session that said it's okay not to let that information out. So now the solar project can go forward in Roanoke. Another SB 990 was enacted to track the Commonwealth's progress towards meeting its energy efficiency goals, which some folks say is not great, but now we're going to have some transparency on that. And then the last good thing that happened is we expanded provisions of state law permitting public entities to use energy performance-based contracting. Virginia's a Dillon rule. You can't do anything unless localities can't do anything unless the state statutes say they can. So this will help out in energy performance-based contracting. So Sierra, I've probably run over my time, but I'm done now.
No, you're just fine. All interesting, and I have some questions about that as well as soon as we get done here. Michael, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about what's happening in Tennessee?
Yeah, it's funny. We actually just had a conversation yesterday about the coal mine pump storage thing in the office here. So, yeah.
That's what we want to be on the map for.
Certainly creative. It's like, I don't know how that works. doesn't seem like we have quite as much going on here in terms of the quantity of bills. So the policy landscape that we're looking at on the state side actually looks pretty good. There's actually a bill that just passed the Senate for residential PACE, which we have commercial PACE right now in Tennessee, but we don't have residential. That's property assessed clean energy. So it looks like it maybe potentially will pass the House and we'll be able to offer residential PACE in the state. Would certainly be a good thing. I think Renew, the company that does those loans in other states, is about to surpass $1 billion in loan products through that program in other states. I would say we're struggling more with TVA, so the Tennessee Valley Authority. Have been in the process. We're part of a Department of Energy accelerator for clean energy and energy efficiency in low-income communities, and we've been trying to develop a concept for a community solar installation whose purpose would be to directly benefit an adjacent low-income neighborhood. We sort of went down the road to try to see how much capacity we could fit on a site, a brownfield cap landfill. And so that put us in the range of like 10 megawatts. We were looking at how to integrate that into TVA's renewables portfolio, and that basically isn't an option. we just talked briefly about the sort of buy all, sell all contracts, and that exists within TVA's footprint, but as a relationship between TVA as the generator and local power companies as the distributors. And so they have to buy all of their power from TVA. So TVA is the gatekeeper in terms of the renewables. And they are not regulated by any of the state regulatory authorities since they're federal. The board also, the TVA board is made up of presidential appointments, and there are 9 positions on the board, 3 of which are vacant, and then 3 of which will run up next year. We don't necessarily see things getting better from that perspective. What TVA is interested in doing is larger scale solar, so in the order of like 70 to 90 megawatts. And then they also have the residential program called Green Power Providers, which will purchase solar from homeowners at retail rate. But at least traditionally, that program is pretty much exclusively used by wealthy white families. So we sort of see that as a little bit problematic, just in that all of the ratepayers in TVA certainly benefit from the environmental benefits of the renewable energy, but we would like to find better scalable ways to roll out renewable energy in lower-income neighborhoods. And we have certainly plenty of case studies from groundswell to grid alternatives and other programs like that. But it's helpful to be able to do the sort of community scale ground mounted solar installations, and the entire, so the TVA's window for projects at that scale is a total of 10 megawatts across their entire footprint. And no single project can be more than 2 megawatts. And there's an extremely arduous application process where you have to partner with one of the local power companies to even submit for that. So it's basically impossible for a community to sort of bootstrap something like this and make it happen. So our alternatives are to basically find a way to do it at residential scale and fall under the green power providers, or doing it with a microgrid basically behind the meter, but for, you know, some number of households. So I'll sort of leave it at that, and then I can go sort of either direction at the state level or more the TVA, depending on what questions people have.
All right. And we can open it up for open conversation. And I just wanted to mention we have a new member, Kevin Moyer. And Kevin is probably very interested in the PACE conversation because this company is PACE Equity, and he does help finance commercial PACE programs. Kevin, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
Thank you, Sarah. I am interested in that. I've been in the PACE space for probably since 2009-10. I was part of some of the early DOE programs focused on energy efficiency, and our Northwest Ohio program was actually one of the first and most successful commercial PACE districts in the U.S. Since that time, I've been involved in forming PACE Equity. I'm a partner in the firm. I'm chief investment officer, and PACE Equity is a commercial PACE project developer, and we provide development, project management, energy engineering, and implementation and financing for property developers or building owners that are interested in doing PACE. And we do that on a nationwide basis. We're in probably 17 of the most active PACE legislated states in the country, and have been a pioneer in actually utilizing PACE in new construction as well as adaptive reuse of older buildings. And we've also been involved in helping advise and helping to start up some statewide programs. We're actively involved in helping set up Show Me PACE in Missouri, and we're currently very actively involved in setting up the Wisconsin statewide program, and have been very active in Milwaukee, where we're headquartered. But certainly very interested to hear that Tennessee is coming online. We recently have added a person in Kentucky as they came online. So as these new markets come online, we're dedicating resources to not only develop projects, but to be able to provide the capital to turnkey the projects. So we actually provide that capital a couple different ways. If a property owner signs our development agreement, we'll actually fund the upfront project management and engineering needed to scope the project and get it off the ground, and then we'll actually provide a commitment for financing for the full implementation. The other thing that I would say just in general is kind of interesting about commercial PACE is I think that more broadly it's being fairly widely embraced by economic development professionals. So and many of those are not only private entities, but certainly government entities at the county and municipal level. But I think they're beginning to see the power of commercial PACE in a capital stack. We've certainly seen PACE in some fairly complex capital stacks. And when you talk to people that are trying to develop or redevelop properties, they'll tell you that one of the hardest things is to find that last gap of financing. And I think PACE does that, does it very well. And we've seen PACE in transactions where you could even have things like EB-5 financing or new market tax credit or historic tax credits, as well as just, you know, simple redevelopment structures where you just have a construction lender and PACE plus the owner equity. We're certainly encouraged by the activity going on nationwide and certainly by the new states that are coming. So. I would also mention we're very interested in seeing Virginia, you know, move forward to. Any questions or comments?
Anybody want to talk to any, ask anybody questions here?
Any California projects?
You want to introduce yourself first? Is that you, Evan?
Yeah, this is Evan Hughes. I'm based in Menlo Park, California.
Yeah, we've actually got a market leader in Southern California in LA. We closed a small project a year ago, but we've got some very large projects under development agreements in California. We see a lot of activity in the multifamily sector and in the hospitality sector in general, along with the typical, you know, office building sector.
Okay, any other comments here?
Kevin, you said that you all were involved in 17 of the most active PACE states. Do you know off the top of your head what the 17 are?
I do. So Connecticut, Ohio, Michigan, now Kentucky, which is new and expected to be active, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Missouri, Arkansas, Colorado, Utah, California, Texas, Florida, and then D.C., Maryland, Northern Virginia area.
Thanks.
Michelle, do you have anything to contribute here? Michelle Halsell from Pennsylvania State University.
No, I quite frankly, I am out of touch on my old state, Arkansas, and its energy legislation, and I am still not up to speed on Pennsylvania and its energy legislation, so I'm just listening.
I had heard Pennsylvania is getting close on pace.
I heard that too. I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Last conversation I had, I thought that they're probably about a year away.
Well, maybe the good news, maybe the bad news is Pennsylvania's legislature is in session all the time, like every year, unlike Arkansas where they only meet every other year. So who knows?
Yeah, we're seeing actually a fair amount of activity starting off in Arkansas. We closed one of the first PACE projects in Arkansas last November, and we've got another couple projects coming right behind that.
Super. My husband was on the first PACE board in Fayetteville.
Is that right?
Yep.
You have to ask him if he knows Jordan Haas.
I think he does. Did y'all come through and your team come through and do some presentations in Fayetteville? Did you work with Steve Patterson and Ken Smith?
They might have. Those names don't sound familiar to me, but I know our VP of development's been down there, and I know Jordan's very active statewide, so.
I'm impressed that many states allow PACE, actually.
Yeah, there's actually like 32 states out of the 50 that have passed enabling legislation. And I forgot to mention, we're in the process of adding somebody in Portland, Oregon.
Larry, anything happening up in your neck of the woods?
Well, we have a new governor who's trying to be very innovative. He was a senior officer with Microsoft, but he's caught in a buzzsaw with the state having about $1 billion drop in revenue with oil prices being down. So he's pretty much playing a defensive game right now, but I would love to start meeting with him later this spring after the legislature, which only meets once every 22 years, is done. He is a big developer in my market area, and I've already met with him a couple of times. But right now, he's like I said, pretty much playing a defensive game on budget, and this summer would be the time to start planning toward the next legislative session and start and build some support and sponsors for. I would love to see residential PACE in our market, simply because we do have a state-owned bank that's flush with money and hundreds of millions of dollars sitting in various reserve pools that could be used for loan money for PACE. That would make sense.
Which state is that?
North Dakota.
North Dakota, okay.
And do you have contact information, like a telephone number or email, that I could get a hold of you?
Yeah, it should be on the website, right, Sierra?
Yeah, all of your information is all on the website. If you click on the contact or connect page on the top and then go on to meet the leaders, it's all there.
Okay.
So that's Kevin Moyer that you want to talk to, Larry.
Okay, great.
Lena, I'm surprised, too, that PPAs are even allowed in Virginia. When I talked to Tony Smith about 3 years ago, I think he said they weren't allowed at all. Has that changed? I mean, apparently it has changed somewhat.
Well, he was responsible for the Dominion pilot program that got enacted. So, that came out of Tony's cease and desist letter from Dominion.
That's not too surprising. He had an interesting workaround using a performance contract instead of a PPA to get his solar done.
Right. Right.
Any other comments or questions here? Evan, anything happening out in California?
I learned that our local countywide community choice aggregation project, Peninsula Clean Energy, has the power purchase agreement guy. To someone that was a consultant for me when I was at EPRI 20 years ago. I just had lunch with him last month. And he's looking to buy power from a closed biomass power plant that's trying to reopen, which he studied on my behalf 20 years ago.
What kind of biomass?
They were burning orchard prunings and urban waste wood, basically anything they could get. But the failure to get credit for kind of waste disposal part of what benefit they provide led them not to be able to continue at the power prices that they needed to keep selling. And now they have a bid into to reopen, and they're trying to work out the economics. That's here in the San Francisco Bay Area. In Tracy is that power plant.
Okay, Annie, go ahead. Is somebody? Okay. Well, it's a small group today compared to normal, so we can end the call if you'd like, if you don't have any more comments or questions for each other.
Oh, this is Evan. I got in a bit late. Was that Cleona who was speaking before Michael?
Actually, yeah. Pronounced Cleona, yes. Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
Any other comments here? Okay. Well, we can go ahead and end the call early today, and we're going to have Katie Ramsey talking about what's going on out in California with the transmission access charge next week. I think it's on Thursday. I'll be sending an email reminder out on that. So if there's no more comments or questions for each other, then we'll just go ahead and end and reconvene next week. And I guess the question is whether two conference calls a month is too much for this group. Maybe we don't have enough people in it to have two calls a month.
You're referring to a conference call next week, which is different from the webinar.
Exactly, yes. The webinar next week is also going to be quite interesting.
That's
so,
Rob,
yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, Rob's talking about net zero energy and what he's doing out in California, working with the utilities on that. He's working with two, I mean, it's kind of an oxymoron because utilities aren't real fond of zero net energy homes. So, but he's got two projects going, one with PG&E and the other one with Edison out in California. So I think that should be a really interesting webinar and how he put that whole thing together and what he's working on regarding that. So, and Larry,
yeah,
how are
you?
It
would be very helpful. Well, I was just going to say it would be very helpful to see how he's able to motivate the utilities, because they typically are not marketing type people, and they look at just controlling their costs rather than trying to grow market or business. So,
right, exactly. I do have one question for Larry. What are you doing up in North Dakota as far as the education is concerned that you're working on with that in Minnesota?
Well, we put on an all-day sessions for appraisers on the 14th of February, and we went from zero appraisers with any training to we 22, so we were excited about that. And the following day, we had 90 realtors and builders and appraisers and bankers show up at a cross-training class that was well-received. And then we took those two classes to Minneapolis at the end of that week, and we had combined about 85 people there. and we got rave reviews from everybody. Most people just didn't realize how much they didn't know about the current state of the art of energy efficiency construction and what the need for documentation and education was, so that the builders don't get blindsided by uneducated realtors and appraisers who derate their building down to a minimum code house because of lack of understanding and documentation.
Yeah, one thing Larry's doing is he's educating all the people who were involved in building, you know, realtors, lenders, appraisers, building inspectors, all the above, on some of the newer policies related to valuing buildings with energy efficiency and renewable energy improvements. And that's something that's been lacking for quite a while. Buildings get these improvements in the cost of the building, and the value of the building doesn't go up. So that's what he's trying to rectify, is doing that type of education programs. So you're doing that in Minnesota right now then?
Yes, two of the larger utilities in the state, XL Energy and CenterPoint, rolled out a $4,000 incentive for high-performance homes that kicked off in January. And knowing that that was coming down the pike, we approached them back in December, asking them if they would participate in helping us do some cross-training to try to get these other groups, such as the realtors and appraisers, to be supportive to the builders by getting training. And to our amazement, the utility said no. But being that they were going to throw a lot of money on the table to market these in the state, we thought it was too good of an opportunity. So I individually approached the Appraisal Institute in Minnesota and the Builders Association of the Twin Cities, and we signed a memorandum of agreement that we would share our losses if we couldn't cover our costs by putting it on. But we just went ahead and put it on, and it basically sort of broke even, but we got rave reviews from everybody, and they said if we would have known how much we learned, we could have gotten hundreds of people here. So we're hoping the second round in the fall will be well attended and we'll cover our costs. But that's the problem out there. You have to dive in and start offering this training, and you have to not just send emails to people. You have to literally knock on doors, make individual personal phone calls to get people to show up to training that they don't think they need. And once you do that, you start to get some momentum, and that's what we're seeing up here.
Well, you get some recommendations off that first group then. I'm impressed that anything is happening up in North Dakota, and Minnesota not so much. They're a little more aggressive, but North Dakota probably not so much either.
Well, the state of the art of construction is affordable. You can do 50% reduction houses with paybacks, even with our low cost 9-cent electricity and 75-cent natural gas. We can still make it work up here. And so we have to just get that message out and make sure that the realtors and appraisers aren't stabbing us in the back out of ignorance because they haven't had any training.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Any comments or thoughts about it for Larry? No? Okay. All right. We'll go ahead and end the call then. Hope to see you next week on the webinar. And also we'll send out an announcement about that again, and also about the conference call next week. And thanks for coming today, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Sierra.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Sierra.
Bye.
Bye.